I'm Holly Case of Cornell University, and this is East Central Europe Past and Present, a blog series that brings you interviews with scholars of East Central and Southeastern Europe, Russia, and the former Soviet Union, in which they offer their views on the past, present, and future of the region. Today we're in Ithaca, talking with David Ost, who's professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. David specializes in political economy, democratization, capitalism, and labor, and is the author of one of the seminal works on Polish solidarity, a book called Solidarity and the Politics of Anti-Politics, which was published in 1990, and another prize-winning book, The Defeat of Solidarity, Anger and Politics in Post-Communist Society, which came out in 2005. So I'd like to kind of begin at the beginning with you, or at least the beginning of your intellectual trajectory. You got your BA degree from the State University of New York in history and Russian. Why these two, and how did you get from there to political science?
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me here to be part of the series. But history and Russian, what happened is I was always a history buff. I certainly was in high school, was very much into history. Two things, both somewhat Russian history, but at first mainly it was the American South, Southern labor history. And I did a project in my senior year on, there was a great seminar at Stony Brook called the Southern Underclass, and was taught with two professors and a literature professor and a woman in administration who had been an activist in the civil rights movement, a freedom rider or something, Vera Roney. And they taught this course on the American South, and I was very into that and the labor issues and Reconstruction, I guess, earlier. Since the Civil War, but particularly Reconstruction, radical Reconstruction. So I was very much into history. In high school, I read Philip Foner's Labor History, right, to try to learn about that. And then I got into Russian history somewhat in high school, but there wasn't that much opportunity. So when I went to Stony Brook, I had studied Russian for several years already in high school. That was a big bonus. I went to the one high school in New York City, Bronx High School of Science, that offered Russian at that time. I didn't go there because of that, but when I learned they offered Russian, I jumped at it, just to learn what the other was. If I could go back just a little bit, one of the interests in Russia came from the fact that I was so interested in American politics. And, that was the great other, the great boogeyman. So I remember, I do remember as a kid, probably 8 or 9 years old, going to a demonstration against the war in Vietnam with my parents. And it was still a time, maybe 1964, where there were more hecklers than protesters, unlike a few years later. And there would be signs of people saying, "Go back to Russia, better dead than red." So I asked my parents, "What's this about?" And so I could see that to be interested in American politics, you kind of needed to address that question of Russia. What was your position on Russia? So when the high school offered Russian, I jumped at that opportunity. In any case, when I started Stony Brook, I decided to actually move away from Russian. I said, "Well, what do I need Russia for?" I actually started, I took an intensive course in Spanish one semester, one in German. I thought I'm going to, move away from Russian. But after the first year, I really, I missed it. I missed the Russian. I was studying the history now. I took history course and Russian history course. I had a great professor, Alan Wildman, who wrote books about, monographs about Soviet military. I think he was working on that at the time. There were also other great history professors there. Werner, maybe that was his last name, a German Jewish professor. I don't remember. I think Werner maybe was his last name. But there were a lot of good, history professors. So I was into that very much. And then I missed the Russian, so I started taking Russian courses, and it was a small department. as it happened, there were a number of Poles who were professors in Russian studies. Jan Kott was there. Mm-hmm. And then there was a young assistant professor, Marika Munk, who I guess I worked with a lot, you know, just in language classes. Edward Chervinsky, another Pole who worked on Russian, and Dostoevsky. So that kind of was one of the things that would propel me later on, you know, or make Poland seem kind of inviting, that I knew all those people. But anyway, so I just, you know, was very much into the history. And then I reobtained that interest. You know, as soon as I started taking Russian again, I really liked it, wanted to stay in it. You know, you also had small classes there compared to the giant ones in history at first at Stony Brook. And then political science, you know, what happened is I graduated in 76. I had already been to Russia now a couple of times. What I really wanted to be was a journalist. And I'd always been interested in that. And then this was the time of the 1976, but they were going to have the Moscow Olympics in 1980. I remember writing to a couple of newspapers or media outlets, you know, saying, telling who I was, I had experience, I knew Russian quite well, maybe I could be interested in, maybe they'd be interested in, you know, having someone go to Russia, help with logistics or something. This was way before, you know, any boycott idea came about. And in any case, so I knew I was interested, you know, I wanted to be a journalist. I was interested in the Soviet area. So I didn't really know much about a PhD. In fact, looking back, it's, you know, amazing how little I knew. I really didn't know what it was. My parents, my father had finished Brooklyn College after several years. My mother also took courses sporadically. So, you know, no real history of education in my family. Formal education, certainly past undergraduate. But I was interested in, journalism and learning about the world. So I thought, well, I didn't want to go to journalism because I wanted to study that topic. So I figured I'll go to graduate school in political science because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't even know what it meant to be a professional historian. I thought I would just go for a year. Again, I didn't know that I was be so into it so much. I can't recall if I applied for four schools, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pittsburgh, and Indiana. I specifically didn't want to stay in the East Coast. This was 77 that I was applying, 76, 77. It was very much dominated, the East Coast school, very much Cold War oriented. And so I wasn't interested in that. I didn't know much about graduate schools or what I'm doing here. But these were a few places that all had some Soviet area program. And then I got accepted to all of them. No money at Michigan. First I got Indiana and Pittsburgh offered me some funds. But then I went out there and wasn't so impressed. And then I got a big fellowship, a Title VI, I think it was called back then, you know, for studying Polish. You needed to study a Slavic, you needed to study a language that was part of the ones that, you know, it was the National Defense Education Act, Title VI, I believe, and they had a whole series of languages you could study and then get a fellowship for. So at that point, I'd applied then for Polish because I went to Stony Brook. I finished in 76. I had gone to Russia for the whole semester in the fall of 75. And that's when I first went to Poland because I went to Russia as a part of, there were 10 students, a student exchange program, the first of its kind in the U.S., 10 students from the SUNY system. Again, I just totally lucked out. You know, no other place had it. But State University of New York had this exchange program that this Chervinsky ran, and also Billington, the future Librarian of Congress, had a hand in building that program and knew some people at SUNY. So there were 10 students selected from State University of New York to study in Moscow at the Institut Иностранных Языков имени Мариса Тореза, right, the French communist. And then 10 students from there who went to Albany. You know, we got the better deal going to Moscow. They went to Albany. So, you know, I was there. I'd been there also with Stony Brook in 1973 in the summer in Leningrad. And now we return to this time. And with us, one of the 10 students was an American girl born in Poland who left Poland in 68-69, Jewish girl from Wrocław, who left in the at the time with her family, obviously at the time of the, you know, anti-Semitic purges, but now as an American she wanted to visit Wrocław, and we had flown to Moscow via Poland, as it happened. So I tagged along. Me and a friend tagged along at the end of the Russian program, and went to Poland in January 76. So I went to Poland in 76 with this friend from Wrocław, tagged along, stayed in Wrocław a bit. It was an interesting time to be there because, as it turned out subsequently from my research, because it was like the last period of Gierek era prosperity. You know, all these, the things that they got in debt for, and there were all these consumer goods for sale very cheaply in the stores. You know, Western consumer items, luxury consumer things, whether it's, you know, Scotch whiskey or nice chocolates or, just all kinds of, plenty of food, plenty of things available in the stores. And that would subsequently change because, you know, I got interested in that. I spoke to people only in Russian and that wasn't a problem. And then a year later, through Stony Brook, they had a program to go to Poland, to Wrocław, for 6-7 weeks. So I was in Poland in 77 for 6 or 7 weeks. And that was already a different time, and things were happening politically there. Because I was interested, you know, always in opposition movements in Eastern Europe. That's how I first learned about things going on in Poland. I studied Russian. I wanted to learn about that other, but, you know, I was never a Soviet supporter. I mean, I hung around some Trotskyist groups and in high school and into college, and that was, in ways as far as Eastern Europe. I mean, in the 1970s, they were almost like the only organizations writing about opposition in Eastern Europe. This was a period of détente. The regular newspapers would just, you know, talk about state-to-state visits and dignitaries and all that. You know, it was only really in the that left-wing press that you could find good, serious articles about, you know, Kuron and Modzelewski, say the open letter of 64, when in fact, you know, they had been Trotskyists for a brief time, and their open letter was very influenced by that. And then opposition movements afterwards. So, you know, so I knew about that, and then I'd been in Poland in 76, so I was already interested in studying Polish, still maybe going to Russia later. So I went 1 year, originally, in political science, and then found graduate school so amazingly fascinating. partly because I'd done a lot of politics, political reading, but because of the time I grew up in, and, you know, it was either more sectarian reading, or then I was involved with that Trotskyist group, read a lot of Lenin and Trotsky, and didn't know that there was all this fascinating Marxist and new types of ways of thinking. Eric Olin Wright had just started teaching in Wisconsin when I was there. Ed Friedman was an advisor, you know, then John Armstrong and Melvin Crone, sort of on the other end of the, Armstrong more, traditional kind of cold warrior, but very serious scholar on Soviet Union. So all of that was really quite interesting, and Wisconsin was a place back then where, being a graduate student in political science, you could in fact take courses in a lot of other fields, you know, unlike today. I mean, they didn't even have a, you know, statistical methodology requirement, say, you know, which would change very soon after. You know, I would take some courses in economics with David Granik, the leading economic historian of the Soviet Union. Took a course with him at the beginning, and you know, and took some philosophy courses. I was interested in critical theory, you know, and then so I was invited to stay. They were paying me a fellowship. No journalist, no, the New York Times wasn't calling me up to say, be our journalist in Soviet Union, so I figured I'd stay.
When you were in the Soviet Union and in Poland in the 1970s, did you have a feeling as though your reasons for being there and other people's reasons for wanting to talk to you were similar? Mm-hmm. Or where did the interests of members of your generation and, you know, the people who went to these places and the people who were in those places of the same generation, where did the kind of interest converge, and where were you kind of looking past each other at something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, certainly when I went, you know, I went three times, first in summer of 73, and that was, you know, after my freshman year of college, and, you know, I was still all of, you know, 17. But that, yeah, that kind of already, you know, set me aside. I mean, it was so unusual to go there in the first place, but, you know, I was quite into it, and known a lot about Russian history already at that point. Yeah, you know, when I came back, it was, yeah, most people of my generation who are not studying or not into those kinds of things would just have the most basic questions, you know, that maybe follow from both traditional American isolationism and not knowledge of the world, but particularly connected to the Cold War. So, you know, they'd ask the most common question, do they have TV there, right? Do they have, can you really eat there? Is someone following you every day and night or something? Or, you know, what is life like there at some very basic level, and being kind of just not knowing anything, but not having a great deal of interest. And I think that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that I really have to think back now, but I remember, you know, how that seemed to set me aside as someone strange, particular. Of course, I kind of liked it. It also, you know, made me somewhat special, and I felt somewhat special having gone there and experienced that and known the language. And and then, of course, when I went for, you know, for several months, that was, almost no one in my generation had done it. There were so few of us in Moscow in 1975 that the ambassador himself invited us, all 10 of us, with our professor, over to his residence for Thanksgiving dinner, right? And made sure after turkey to show us a James Bond movie on 16 millimeter, you know, to make sure, like, we remember whose side we're supposed to be on.
Which one was it?
I don't remember, but it was definitely showed us a James Bond movie. You know, 007. And we were, you know, we were kind of laughing about that and all upset that they gave us one portion of turkey and then took the rest away, you know? Hungry college students in Russia. In any case, of course, later on, that would be different. I came back from Soviet Union from the long stay in 75, and I didn't return to Stony Brook except for one summer course because I had enough credits to graduate. So I just, you know, had a Ural pass mostly for the spring semester of 76 and needed one course in Chinese history in the summer to graduate. And then I took a year off, and I was driving a taxi in New York and figuring out what to do next. I almost went in the direction of pursuing, you know, the Southern labor movement, the Southern underclass. I met Barbara Koppel, who had done her movie Harlan County, USA, that won an Academy Award, and you know, I had done this paper on Southern labor and the labor strikes in 1929 in the South, and wrote to her, tried to get a job with her, took a film class even, maybe I'm going to go in that direction. I did have an idea of being a filmmaker, actually, you know, took a film class and would have been more interested in that than graduate school. I applied to graduate school too, just in case, and you know, the film thing didn't come through, and graduate school did, so you know, I went there, and yeah, I was all interested in Pittsburgh too, because they had a great film here. It was a great film place, independent film place. But I subsequently went to Madison, which was a great choice. When you know, in graduate school, it was a little different. But you know, I guess.
Did you have? I mean, who did you interact with in the Soviet Union and Poland? Who were your friends, and what kinds of things did you talk about with them?
So, in the first time I went there, in 73, we went to Leningrad, and, you know, in a couple of days, we met, just walking around the street, we met some, you know, kids our age, with long hair, who would, I guess they heard us talking English, maybe, but we ended up speaking Russian with them, but they came over and they were interested mostly in Western music, right? People used to ask us, do you know, their favorite group at the time was Deep Purple. I said, what? Deep Purple. Can you figure out? No, Deep Purple.
Oh, Deep Purple.
Right, Deep Purple. Some of them happen to say it like French, or at least, right, which I subsequently learned, you know, Medvedev claims to be a Deep Purple fan, you know, so they were big at that time in the 70s. Of course, a lot of Western music was. So, you know, so we met these kids and talked a lot about, you know, rock music. That was a big thing. In fact, that was in Leningrad, was the one time ever to this day that I've ever performed on a stage singing music, because they took a few of us to some club, some student club. We had to take an elektrichka, an electric,
tram.
It was kind of one of these suburban trains, right, that takes you just a little ways outside of Leningrad. Went somewhere, you know, maybe 20 minutes away one time, took us to some club where actually there are hundreds of people. There was some records, or maybe there was some Russian group playing, but we went and there were several of us there, and they said, well, you're Americans, you can be, you're a rock band. And as it happened, you know, one friend did play guitar and another one played drums, and I used to play violin. They didn't have one there, so I became the lead singer. And you know, when we got up there and we sang Paul McCartney's Get Back. And and I knew the lines for the first verse, and then the second verse came around, and I didn't know the line. But then I realized, oh, I had a revelation. You know, nobody knows English, right? Everyone. This was 1973. Not many people knew English at all. You know, so I basically looked around the room, and I started, you know, doing an ad lib or a riff, saying whatever, you know. Then there was the car that took the elevator going to the students dancing. And then I just had to find the next tune that I had to make a rhyme, you know, for the next thing. So my friends look at me like playing, like, what are you doing? And I'm saying, well, I don't know. So anyway, we finished. We did that. Maybe another song. You know, we were rock stars. You know, so that with them, with that group was a big topic of interest. Then there was two other groups. Then we met, and I don't recall if it was through one of them or through another friend, we met this photographer, a couple of photographers. I have a photograph in my office to this day from one of them, who were doing some real interesting independent stuff. I guess that would have been in 75. No, that was earlier. That was still 73. But that was the time, actually. 73, 74 is the time when the independent art scene started getting very big in the Soviet Union. In 75, there was a big crackdown just when I went there and and I met some people who were part of that. And in 73, that was already starting. So we had one group of friends there who were photographers. And I remember, right, exchanging. I had an old Yashica mat that I exchanged for a Soviet camera. So with them we talked about art. They were more interested in aesthetics, somewhat political issues. They were jazz people too. A lot of big jazz musicians were going over there who they had met. So there was that circle. Then the one other circle I happened to meet was a Jewish intellectual circle, and that I met in a very interesting, fascinating way that I guess tells me a lot about Soviet Union, or I don't know, or getting older, or I don't know what that was. So I'm in Leningrad on the subway, taking the subway, and it's crowded, and there's maybe a seat, and someone sees me, catches my eye, young man, but older than me, maybe around 30 or something, late 20s, 30, makes a motion, do I want to sit there? So I start, okay, yeah, I'll sit there. And then as I sit down, he says, wie Französisch, darling? You're French, are you? And I look at him like perplexed, like I'm French. And then he looks at me like, he says, Yashuchu. I'm joking, right? You're a Jew like me, sit down. And I'm like, what? I was dumbfounded. My mouth is open, he sees I'm from the U.S. I don't know if that was clear the first when he invited me to sit down. But in any case, right, he was, what did he do? I think he was some kind of scientist. Because I remember meeting another guy, Grisha Rosenblatt was the other one, who was both a folk singer on the side, but also, right, did electrical engineering, right. Wow, that's right. I remember when I got back to America, I arranged a subscription to this guy, to some journal of electrical engineering, And the first guy I met on the subway, I forget his name, but, so I got to know a little bit this circle of Jewish. This was also the time of big emigration to the United States, so there was a big Jewish interest, this started in 73, but maybe more in 75. This could have happened in 75, what I'm telling you now, because I remember going to a synagogue on Simchas Torah. And I was Jewish cultural roots, but more secular, left-wing secular background. Wasn't bar mitzvahed myself, so I don't know much about, the Jewish tradition, religious tradition, more, culturally so. But this is a joyous holiday, and I remember going to the one synagogue in Moscow, working synagogue in 1975, right near Khmelnytsky Street. Right, the great Ukrainian peasant leader who's also been accused of, organizing pogroms. So right near Khmelnytsky Street was the synagogue. And I remember, the whole square was packed with people outside. The synagogue was full. People were there on the outside playing guitar, singing, talking with each other. Anyone who wanted to go into the synagogue, any male, since there were no yarmulkes, they'd fold up Pravda and put it on their head and walk in to the synagogue. That was their cap, folded up Pravda. So I met that circle there too. So I guess there were those three circles I got to know in Russia.
What about Poland?
So Poland, when I first went there in 76, I was with that Polish-Jewish girl, and we stayed with relatives of hers, friends. I think they were just, friends, close friends from Wrocław, There were two young men about my age. Excuse me. I went with a colleague of mine, an American, Ed Cook. We traveled there together. I was, 20. He was 21. And they were about the same age. Remember the first day we get to Wrocław, we get to their home, and they just had a giant bed. The two guys slept in the same bed together. And so it was very huge, so we slept there too. So there were four students, four male students, sleeping in the same bed together, which... But they had a blind mother, and that's why, who didn't want to leave. That's why they stayed behind in Poland. And, and they were, so that was one group I met. Also, there was in Wrocław a student from Stony Brook I met, Mark Tucci, who had started medical school in Wrocław. I guess he, didn't get into med school in the U.S., and there was a number of people studying abroad, some in Poland and Wrocław, so, I met him too. Then when we went back the next year, I met students mostly, right, when I was there in the summer of 77, we stayed in an academic, a dorm in the summer that was a student hostel, and, we had some local person who was helping us. I met a number of students who knew who were living there, taking, I think, pedagogy courses. I think they were taking pedagogy courses, a number of young women. We all communicated in Russian. And, and there we talked, a bit. I guess personal things. I don't remember talking much politics, not in 76. In Russia, I also had one other friend, a close, an Armenian friend, Livon Sarkisyan, who I'm in touch with to this day, an older guy, about 35, who was, studying German. He became subsequently, the leading Armenian is from Armenia, German-Armenian translator. Right, of course, knew Russian fluently. Subsequently, has traveled to Germany many times. Someone who I realized, was gay. He couldn't talk about it at that time. It took many years before he could let it out. And, to this day, it's very tough being gay in Armenia. Though that's a whole nother topic. He's managed to work it out a little better in the last several years. But in any case, so we talked some politics. I remember for my 20th birthday party in Moscow in October 1975, I had a big party in my room, and it was the one time in my life that I got so drunk that I didn't, get sick, but I said things of which I had zero memory the next day. It never happened before. And some people said I started talking a lot more about politics, and others were saying, maybe I shouldn't talk about that. Because, the room was monitored. It seemed that there was some, recording, because occasionally people would know what we were doing or where we were going at certain times.
Is there, to your knowledge, a file on you?
I'm not sure. I did go a couple of years ago and ask for a file, and they said I was there. I never did get it. They said, I don't know. I think there must be, because as many years later, I was, interrogated at the border. I was detained a couple of times in Poland, or maybe just once or twice, and held. They confiscated things from me at the border, so there obviously was at one time some file, but I don't know, and I've never seen it, so I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we could talk a bit about, in 1993, you did a translation of a book by Adam Michnik, The Church and the Left. Can you talk a bit about your reasons for doing that and your kind of intellectual relationship to Michnik and his work?
So, as someone who was interested in political opposition in Poland from the mid-70s on, the name Adam Michnik was already one of the names I knew rather early, already in the 70s. When I got to Poland to do, all up till now I've been talking about the time I just went as a student, when I went as a graduate student, I started graduate school at Madison in 1977, and I did not go back to Poland at all until 1981, until during the Solidarity period. Mm-hmm. First I went in March of 81 for a couple of weeks because I wasn't sure if it would last very long. I had a Fulbright that would start there in September 1981, but I went earlier because I didn't know if Solidarność would last that long. So I went there in March of 81 and went to, I was there for some commemoratory meeting, a 13th anniversary of events of 1968, in which Michnik spoke at. Michnik, like many of, us people interested in Eastern Europe, kind of activists and somewhat on the left, because Michnik had at that time defined himself specifically as belonging to what he called the secular left, a term he would stop using for himself, already in 1981. I was quite interested in him. He was one of the heroes of this time. I didn't meet him when I was there in 81. I came back in September 81, and I did stay in Poland until December 82, through the period of martial law. I didn't meet him at all at that time. So actually what happened is in the late 80s, trying to think when exactly, I got an offer to translate that book, and I jumped at it. It was a very influential book for me. And also I knew this would be a chance to meet Michnik and get to know him. And also, I did it under conditions I'd write an introduction to the volume, which I did. So,
in what respect was it? Did it impact you? I mean, what was it about it when you read it the first time?
I think I read. I probably read much more about it than I read it until I translated it. What seems so important, and I may be confusing what I'm saying now with how I subsequently came to see it, this book, written in 76 or 77, something like that, was this book where, actually the key word for him in that book is dialogue. It's translated here as The Church and the Left. Polish title is Kościół Lewica Dialog, Church, Left, Dialogue. And his dialogue, his way of dealing with the problems from within the left tradition, acknowledging that, being critical of the church, but being critical of the left, citing people on all sides. And I guess what happened is that, in graduate school, I had changed a lot. As I had said, the one kind of Marxism I was familiar with was this sectarian Marxism. And I had moved away from that. Partly, when I was 19 years old and I went to the Soviet Union, I was part of an organization that believed if I went to the Soviet Union and came back alive, that they would never know who I was, because Stalinists had persecuted Trotskyists. And even though this was 1975, it seemed utterly absurd to me, I left. I was no longer part of that movement, but I went to graduate school and learned a whole different kind of, democratic left thinking that was certainly very popular at the time. I was influenced by the so-called revisionist Marxists at that time that I'd read a lot about. There was the journal Labor Focus on Eastern Europe that had a lot of that. And, Michnik was part of this tradition that was right? Very much fighting for social justice, as he understood it, but, you know, managed to be critical of the left tradition, non-sectarian, in a way that, yeah, I guess nowadays we can't even remember that in the 70s there was still you know, a number of people in the Western left and in the East as well, you know, still had a kind of gut loyalty to the Soviet system. That had changed a lot in the 60s. The new left was, you know, rather anti-Soviet. But, you know, but 77, the new left is still, you know, only 30, 35 years old. There was a whole, you know, part of the world, part of the intellectual world that was still focused in certain ways around the Soviet Union and just didn't know how to be leftist in an open manner. And Michnik's book seemed to, Michnik himself, right, that tradition seemed to be open to that. I think that's what was so fascinating to many of us in the West, is that there was this, right there, they could take for granted. They knew that they were, that the Soviet-type system was not the realization of left dreams. And also they didn't have to worry about that being critical of that would put them in league with the John Birch Society, you know, or the extreme right, right? So Michnik had that, as Kuron's work did at that time. So The Church and the Left was a book that, again, was open, was about this dialogue, was about seriously engaging in debate and discussion, critical, self-critical. So that's what I had found when I first.
So could you talk
when
a
I first
about,
read? By the time I translated it, you know, Michnik was someone else, and things had changed a lot. But
could you talk a bit about what it was like meeting Michnik and how you see him now and how he has changed, things like that?
So, I guess I met him for the first time. Somehow I think it was 1988. I know the book came out in 93. Oh, okay. I've got to think of something in my head. 87, 88. Must have been 88. Because, yes, I definitely remember I was translating that book already. I started translating some of it in the summer of 88. Right, so I probably met him in the spring or maybe early summer of 1988. So I remember it was still right before 89, so Solidarność wasn't re-legalized, but it was after the amnesty of 86, so everyone was, you know, walking around. And so I was in touch as someone who was translating his book, and, you know, it was a thrill to meet Michnik. Michnik among certain selection, among a large group of the Warsaw intelligentsia, pro-Solidarność intelligentsia, was a kind of god, right? I remember being in 1981, being at an outdoor book market or outdoor flea market where they were selling books, and I picked up a Michnik book, and the guy selling it, what did he say? Oh, you know, Michnik, nasz, did he say, nasz bohater, nasza Biblia? That's right. I think he said about the book, you know, this is our Bible, right? This Church and the Left, right? Precisely is, for that kind of generation. So for me, it was quite thrilling. I realized, you know, I learned a lot about Michnik. Subsequently, Michnik, you know, has a way, one of the, his powers, his strengths, has been, you know, he's a rather magnetic persona, personality, very self-confident, although with this very ironic, ironically or paradoxically, with a very strong stutter, especially at that time. It's a little better now, but he could hardly speak publicly without a, you know, a very strong stutter, which actually I had as a kid, but you know, my second grade, third grade, I was over it, you know, and he still had it very much. But, you know, when I met him, he took me under his wing. And so suddenly I was, you know, someone like, oh, I was okay. And he introduced me to other people. We're walking on the street and he meets, you know, another core person, Andrei Tselinski, introduces me to him. And, you know, so I was like, wow, I'm part of this circle. As I subsequently realized, you know, that kind of the thing I felt, the thing that so many Poles have felt, and then also rebelled against, because Michnik can also, you know, decide that you're not one of his friends, right? And I think a lot of people are kind of maybe angry at their being seduced by Michnik, but if you're seduced favorably, that's very nice. But if you're seduced and allow yourself to be seduced and then are spurned, right, which happens, then there's a kind of feeling of, you know, I shouldn't have allowed myself. Who is this person anyway? Why is he spurning me? You know, and a real kind of personal dislike, a personal anger that comes over the political, and a lot of the right-wing rejection of Michnik subsequently, I know, is based on that. I mean, I've heard from certain people that story. And then especially a younger generation, maybe those who were, you know, young 40s now, or even, yeah, young 40s, who would have been, what, you know, they're high school kids in the 70s or in the 80s during the Solidarity period, so not able to be part of that opposition, but, you know, looking forward to it, came of age after 1989 when Michnik's already a very big figure. You know, they still want to be more radical activists in ways, and, you know, seeing themselves as kind of Michnikites as a kind of like in the past, but Michnik is now, you know, the editor of a newspaper, talking with leading politicians. He's moved away from being any kind of radical activist, and a lot of people, you know, felt like looked up to him and felt spurned by him. I mean, some people, you know, two of the leading intellectuals in Poland right now, I mean, Cezary Michalski and Agata Bielik-Robson. There are a couple now, in fact, but, you know, and they've been around the political right, but they've even talked about it in some recent books, right? Being kind of close to Michnik and to that circle, wannabes, right? Wanting to be close, and then being spurned, not being able to be part of that milieu. I mean, there's a lot in Poland based around these milieus, right? That Janine Wedel wrote a book about that the private Poland, you know, about the środowisko, and you know, this Warsaw intellectual circle was very strong. So, you know, with me and Michnik, I at first wasn't subsequently, I didn't quite understand that so much. I met him a couple of times, you know, first that first time in 88, then I came back. I mean, then things changed, 89, and I didn't work on it in a while. And then in 90, 91, it was getting close. I saw Michnik again now in Gazeta Wyborcza, you know, and asked him, we needed him to write a special introduction to the American edition, which he did. And I remember when he wrote in the introduction, you know, that I wasn't going to do this, but I was asked by my friend, David Ost, and I'm reading this like, my friend, you know. There were different words in Polish you can use, any word that use that strong word friend, and I remember that's very odd. I mean, I'm not his friend, that's very nice, I feel flattered, but also at this time that's, you know, strange. And I mean, I had to translate that as such, right? But that also, you know, I understood again that power of being a friend, and a friend of Michnik, like, I guess, you know, the friends of Bill that were talked about, right? And of course they're of the same generation and part of that, you know, kind of dynamic people in the new left in their various countries to some extent, and maybe Clinton a little less so, but
one thing we haven't talked about is your work. So let's talk about that. Your two largest contributions to in my view, are your two books, Solidarity and the Politics of Anti-Politics and the Defeat of Solidarity. And what I find particularly wonderful about these two books is that they're connected. And I would love for you to talk to us a bit about how the first book came into being, and about its lifespan and reception, and then the second book, and how it was born out of what happened after.
So, the first book, of course, was based on my dissertation. When I originally went to Poland on the Fulbright Fellowship in 81, you know, I thought I was going to do a dissertation on strikes in the 1940s, the book that Patrick Kenny subsequently wrote. Then Solidarność had happened by the time I got there, so I turned my interest to that instead when I was there. When martial law was declared, I did more research on the past, the 1940s, 1950s. I went to some archives. But then afterwards, when I came back in 86, I realized, well, no, you know, the main thing was to write about that Solidarność movement. And I wanted to... you know, I'm still very much a historian. I saw myself very much a historian and political scientist, too. But I knew that certainly at this time in 81, there was a lot of that basic, intimate history that just still was not known, right? What exactly happened both leading up to the strikes, especially in the first period after the strikes. I mean, one thing I guess I still think that book has that I don't think I've never seen in any other book is a kind of detailed account of, you know, the developments in Poland, like in August, September, things going on with the official trade unions, with the party, you know, what exactly it looks like in a day-to-day basis. You know, I wanted to stop time. I'd always felt back then that there was a lot of talk about what's going on in Poland, and, you know, that was now a world historic event, the Solidarność movement at that time. And a few people knew much about what it really was. And I knew that, having been there a lot at the time, and I wrote some articles for In These Times that would talk about that. So you know, I felt there was a real need to tell that story, that only then could we philosophize, theorize about it if we know what actually happened there. So that was a main part of the dissertation. You know, and I remember showing it to a professor. Like, I started writing some of that, detailing what exactly happened, going through the newspapers. I came back with, you know, tons of newspapers, official newspapers, some underground stuff. But you know, so I wanted to tell that story, what happened there. Then, you know, I needed some hook after a while, and you know, I came up with this corporatist concept, which I would subsequently, to this day, you know, keep working on. But put in that as like, might there be what could be understood as some kind of corporatist solution, which in fact was being proposed before martial law was declared. In any case, the dissertation was finished in 1986. Then I got a job, my job where I'm still at Hobart William Smith in 1986. So I put that aside for a while. And then I had a leave in 1988 for a semester. I was at Harvard, this Russian center, whatever it was called back then. Maybe it was the Davis Center. But it was still a Russian center then. I don't know if they had the Center for European Studies yet or was underdeveloped. For whatever reason, I had a junior leave here, and I went there in the fall of 88 to actually finish that, to turn it into a manuscript, a book manuscript. So, you know, I did a lot of revisions, and I talked a lot about what was going on in the years since then. Amnesty had been declared. There was a lot of openness. You know, I knew very closely, because I was going to Poland very regularly after 81 and after I returned in 82. So I wanted to tell about what was happening in the underground, too, in 87 and 88. I guess that, too, is one of the things that's not so much done elsewhere. One of the advantages is that I was finishing the book before re-legalization, before 1989. So, you know, I I couldn't get detained by what happened, by the telos, right? But it was still talking about what was actually going on. So I wrote that up in detail and then sent it out for publication. Someone from who had read my stuff in these times, Carmen Siriani, had suggested a Temple University Press, so I sent it to them and they were interested in it. And then I was finishing it up in 1989. Basically, I sent them the manuscript in January 89, sent them the finished manuscript. And of course, everything started changing the rest of it. But because of a normal book schedule, it takes several months anyway. So they were happy to arrange something special. I mean, I wrote a substantive, epilogue in May of 89, and then before Proofs came out, after I got Proofs, they allowed me because then it was November 89, right? So I wrote another 5 pages, and luckily, I mean, insofar as the manuscript was talking about a corporatist solution, and there could be this way out, and party power is is eroding in this way, so I mean, I wasn't one who was wrong. I mean, in some ways, I think a lot of people like us who were graduate students, did anticipate in ways, right, the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, we didn't say that specifically, but, as I wrote, was saying, well, party power is eroding. Here are these other groups, coming. And that was a view that was rather poo-pooed by the official establishment. Mm-hmm. I still remember the first article I published on that. Truly academic article was published in Eeps, one of the first volume of Eeps, and Daniel Chereau, I still remember it's the only time this happened, actually called me up in 1988 and said, we're accepting your manuscript, but you have a line like this that the party is giving up power, and you can't publish that. That's wrong, we know. And to my chagrin, I accepted this. I mean, I didn't know how weird it was to ask something like that of a writer, but I was a young author and, did cut that out, in any case. So when I wrote those epilogues, then it took me into the present. But, what I was interested in, I didn't write the book for Poland, right? Only now, today, is it being translated for the first time, that book, by the European Center of Solidarity in Gdansk. They're issuing in Polish translation a number of the early books from the 80s, early 90s that were never translated into Polish. And that's being translated right now. But I wrote it for totally an American audience, and my, the issue there was about Solidarność's theory of democracy. That's what was my object there. Because I was always interested in Poland, not just because of Poland's fascinating, but what do we learn from there? Poland was fascinating, but it was fascinating in particular ways. What could we learn of that for America, for American politics? I always have had as an academic, and probably especially more so, earlier, of this kind of commitment to making it real. It has to be practical. It has to speak to some important issues about politics, and so I saw that they had this incredible kind of authentic, it seemed, democracy. The kind of thing that subsequently you could read about and, as I think I indicated in that, I talked about in that first book, it was the kind of things that others have written about during, say, the Paris Commune, or the Soviets of 1917, or the Spanish anarchist communities, of this time, and where workers seem to be in power. Now, Poland at that time, like the Eastern Bloc, were very working class countries, right? Most people were working in factories, right? And there were a lot of intellectuals and engineers connected to factories. And there were, of course, the institutes and the intellectuals, but who were also employed by the state. And those who had a prominent voice, were those. Revisionism was certainly very strong in Poland, when Gomulka was in power for a long time. So Poland, as we know, always had a lot more toleration for critical views, right? Critical, intellectual, liberal left views were very strong there. So the ideas of democracy that came through in practice during the Solidarity period, some of which I had occasion to witness because I was there for, you know, 3 months, and also in March of 81, I traveled around a lot, went to a lot of factories, went to a lot of meetings at Solidarity headquarters, but sometimes in factories or in occupied buildings, you know, and would actually see this thing that people have written about, that these workers' meetings, and there are these intellectuals invited, and they would speak about these issues, and they had common issues, and there really was a, you know, a kind of love affair with workers, right? Very similar to how communists looked at workers in the 1940s, right? Mm-hmm. But here you had critical left intellectuals, or even some right-wing conservative intellectuals who saw, oh, look, we were talking and yakking all this time, and here the workers are the ones who were actually able to do it, right? Mm-hmm. Michnik and Kuron famously recommended that Gdansk workers, you know, drop the demand for independent trade unions in 1980, because they thought it couldn't be obtained, and then of course it was obtained. So the kind of so I wrote that book also talking about this, you know, the ideas of Michnik had called it one time anticipatory democracy, which is very similar to some ideas, you know, coming out of the New Left, right? Like, you know, I had this slogan, I don't think it's in the book, like, changed people change the world, right? You can't just take power and think, like in the old left tradition, you take power and we'll do it differently. Well, you know, no, you take power and you're if you're connected to power and to talk of all thesis of politics, then it's, you know, repression against the others, right? So here there seemed to be a kind of democracy, council democracy, direct democracy, and it was fascinating and it seemed to work. Now in my book there's also something that actually most people don't get there, maybe because people don't read it for that purpose. But there's also in this first book, right, I talk about how that model of politics, of anti-politics, right, like being political but not being about taking power but of transforming society, right? Like, we don't need to control state apparatus and we don't want to be repressive, and this is a way of doing so. But I also talked about how, you know, that by late 81 it was clear that didn't pass the test. I mean, you needed to deal with politics as well, right? You couldn't be anti-politics forever. And Solidarnosc was spared dealing with that by the introduction of martial law, right? I mean, they didn't know where to go, but then they were repressed, and, you know, the great struggle, or, you know, what does Kundera call it, the great, in the unbearable lightness of being, the great march, right? That could continue, right? And it kind of went back to this great march, although some political opposition was emerging in late 81. So my book was written to talk about that theory of democracy based around this concept of civil society, which when the book came out in 1990, it was still a rather new term. What does this mean? Civil society really did come back into play in the West through developments in the East, and that happened there as well. So that's what, you know, what that book was about. And as I say, I wrote the two epilogues, finishing in November 89. Again, a good bit of luck, because at that point, really things were settled, as it were, right?